face and shoulders, and all the way down the back, relaxing the tailbone all the way down the legs into the feet, and keeping the crown lifted and sensing some space around the center of the chest. Maybe the shoulders come to the sides. And then just resting here, maybe feeling the breath moving in and out of the nostrils. And then from wherever you feel your heart center is, I'm just going to make an offering of our time together this evening. So may it serve for the awakening of all beings. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be happy. May all beings be at peace. I'm going to take a deep inhale and breathe it out. Okay, so we are on the Tao Te Ching, and we are this week going to be looking at verse 4. So verse 4 is very short. So this may, we'll see how we go. Maybe this will be a very short evening and we'll have some music afterwards. We'll see how it goes. But it's not a small topic because the topic is really emptiness and being an empty vessel. Something we could in theory talk about if there were words that didn't fill the void and make it meaningless. I'm just going to pour a tea, excuse me. Got a bit of a cold coming, I think. Okay, right. So I'm going to read a couple of versions of this short verse. The first is Stephen Mitchell's, and he says, "The Tao is like a well, used but never used up. It is like the eternal void, filled with infinite possibilities. It is hidden, but always present. I don't know who gave birth to it. It is older than God." And in Wayne Dyer's version, he says, "The Tao is empty, but inexhaustible, bottomless. It is hidden but always present. I do not know who gave birth to it. It seems to be the common ancestor of all, the father of things." And then finally, Solala Talu's, which is the one we're probably going to work with today. "Tao is an empty vessel. It is used but never exhausted. It is the fathomless source of the 10,000 beings. It is tranquil and serene and endures forever. I do not know where it comes from. Yet it is the ancestor of us all." So as you can see, sort of a nuance between them all. Stephen Mitchell refers to the empty vessel as a well. But I kind of like Solala Tower's interpretation as an empty vessel. So I thought we'd just as usual just sort of go through this. And I made some notes. What struck me when I was contemplating this, Tao is an empty vessel used but never exhausted, or Tao is an empty vessel used but never used up, is that there seems to be this paradox that we're dealing with when it comes to the Tao, that's used but never exhausted. This idea of, as Stephen Mitchell says, it's like the eternal void, but it's filled with infinite possibilities. So there's this idea, it's empty, but it's also full of something. And we get this a lot as we see, or as we will see, as we gradually make our way through the Tao Te Ching, that at first it seems like the Tao Te Ching is full of these paradoxes. It's dark, but it's also light, and it's this and it's that. And as we talked about before, it's like kind of this yin and the yang rather than the yin or yang. It's the two together. And in this case, it's saying it's empty, but it's also full, rather. So to be honest, at the beginning, you sort of think, well, this is a paradox. It's empty, but it's also filled. And then as you begin to contemplate it, you begin to realize, I can begin to see that in its emptiness, it is full. So if that sounds a bit confusing, the empty vessel is talked about not just in the Tao. You'll find the empty vessel mentioned in the Heart Sutra, or emptiness certainly in the Heart Sutra in Buddhism. It's mentioned in Zen Buddhism. In the Bible, there's reference to the empty vessel a few times, actually. In Kabbalah, it talks about the empty vessel attempting to be filled and then shattering. And then we become sort of these split souls going back to the empty vessel. I didn't have a chance to look in Sufism, but Sufism sort of certainly ties into it later on, as we'll talk about the emptiness as a means of surrender. So I just kind of wanted to read a couple of other things about this idea of emptiness before we move on. And this is in the way of, and I always pronounce it wrong, Chan Fu by Thomas Merton. It's his interpretation. And we have this: the empty boat. He who rules men lives in confusion. He who is ruled by men lives in sorrow. Yao therefore desired neither to influence others nor to be influenced by them. The way to get clear of confusion and free of sorrow is to live with Tao in the land of the great void. If man is crossing a river and an empty boat collides with his own skiff, even though he be a bad-tempered man, he will not become very angry. But if he sees a man in a boat, he will shout at him to steer clear. If the shout is not heard, he will shout again and yet again and begin cursing, and all because there is somebody in the boat. Yet if the boat were empty, he would not be shouting and not angry. If you can empty your own boat, crossing the river of the world, no one will oppose you and no one will seek to harm you. So I kind of love this idea of we are a boat and we're going to empty our boat and become this empty vessel. Tao is an empty vessel used but never exhausted. And elsewhere, I've been reading about how, especially when it comes to the Tao Te Ching, a lot of the teachers were saying that that it is in being empty that you become this source of energy, that the Tao flows through you, that you become one with the Tao, that it flows through you. So even though the Tao is empty, it is flowing. And then when you empty yourself, you become a place for that energy to come from. And Eva Wong, who teaches sort of the mystic secret teachings of Taoism, says this: form is created from emptiness. After form emerges, it seeks to return to emptiness. Mind and spirit are originally empty. Energy, however, has form. If the mind is empty, the spirit will be calm and energy will be plentiful. So, in being empty, in emptying the mind, energy will come through. If the mind is wayward, however, the spirit will leave and energy will be corrupted. So, we know this ourselves that if the mind is all over the place, we can get very tired, like spirit isn't there, we don't have access to this infinite energy. The mind of the sage is always empty because she knows how to cultivate her spirit and energy. And that's Eva Wong. So we're really, the Tao is just sort of teaching us what the Tao is. And this is, interesting. It's one of the first times it's seeking to explain exactly what the Tao is. And it's also telling us how to become like the Tao, so that we and the Tao are one. And originally, we were also empty, and we're also going to try and return to this emptiness. And the Tao is the empty vessel. So, used but never exhausted, the fathomless source of the 10,000 beings. Or the Tao is empty but inexhaustible, bottomless, the ancestor of it all. Or the Tao is like a well, used but never used up. It is like the eternal void, filled with infinite possibilities. So I wanted to talk about what emptiness allows for, because it seems like it can be a bit esoteric just to talk about being empty. And I was reading a couple of comments from the Buddhist standpoint of emptiness to and I just thought I'd share this with you. So emptiness is not complete nothingness. And that's something I think we all can sort of sound confusing for us when we think about emptiness, that there's nothing there. It doesn't mean that nothing exists. What it does mean is that things do not exist the way that we suppose that they do. So it's like another way of saying this would be to unlearn all the learning. To become empty is to do all the unlearning and go back to just being open. In his book on the Heart Sutra, the Dalai Lama calls emptiness the true nature of things and events. But in the same passage, he warns us to avoid the misapprehension that emptiness is an absolute reality or an independent truth. So, in other words, emptiness is not some kind of separate realm apart from this world. Emptiness is the true nature. And if you've studied A Course in Miracles at all, the practices that you do through the workbook of nothing has any meaning, the things I look about have no meaning. My thoughts have no meaning, my thoughts create a meaningless world. This is kind of the same. It's kind of the same essence. That is what the workbook is essentially trying to do is get you to a state of emptiness. So if you can think of it like that, this empty vessel means that there's nothing adding labels, nothing adding words. You're just in a state of complete openness. Openness to what is. And when you're in that place, then things can just arise and move through you. As I say, so the Heart Sutra in Buddhism talks a lot about emptiness. And for the Tao, it's going to come up again and again, this idea of this empty vessel and this well that's empty, and how to make ourselves empty. So every word, every thought, and every label are our empty vessels for meaning. So we are filling everything with meaning all the time, and filling in isn't what we are want to do. It is emptying that that would be preferable on a spiritual path. So instead of adding meaning to everything, we are emptying everything of meaning to allow ourselves to be empty, to be filled. And then the natural question is, well, what are we emptying ourselves to be filled with? There's a couple of ways of looking at it. So the Salala Tower talks here about sort of what the Tao says, and this is again Chuang Tzu. It says, dwell in the empty chamber within, which is full of light, and by dwelling in this stillness, great blessings will come your way. If you do not rest there, your mind will keep racing madly like a wild horse. But if you keep yourself centered and still deep within this empty place, and allow your thinking mind to dwell outside, you will attract helpful spirits and God will come to your aid. So from his perspective, this emptiness is inside and we can just access it and move with inside it. But I wanted to share also, as I mentioned, the empty vessel appears in the Bible a few times, and then I was remembering that in Regina's the Holy Spirit's interpretation of the New Testament, there was in Corinthians talk of the empty shell. And so I thought I would just read this to you because I thought this sort of gives you a sense of when you are empty, what are you filling yourself with? Or what fills into you, I suppose, what comes in its place. And so this is Corinthians towards the end of chapter 1. Choose not to cling to yourself as you perceive yourself to be. Choose instead to lay yourself aside and to become like an empty shell. That which is emptied shall be filled by me, and the one who is filled by me shall know his own fullness. So again, we have this idea of being full and empty at the same time. But instead of full of our own mind and our small self, we are now full of spirit. This is the most difficult to do. Yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit about how we might approach it. As an empty shell, it goes on, this is Corinthians chapter 2, you are filled by me. As an empty shell, you witness the reason that is your own. Lay down yourself in service to me that you may serve me and come to know yourself. That which is revealed to you as you lay yourself aside and willingly become as an empty shell is also revealed to the mind. That which is revealed to the mind is useful in the healing of God's holy Son. So that's everyone. In laying yourself aside and willingly becoming a shell, you offer yourself to be used in holiness. So becoming empty, allowing yourself to be filled, you are then able to serve others. So your vessel now runneth over. That which you offer yourself is that which you are. In laying yourself aside as an offering of grace to holiness, holiness in its grace is offered fully to you. That which has opened itself to the Spirit of God by becoming an empty shell has made a statement to the mind that it is its own. It has said, I know I am not this thing I thought I was, as this thing cannot be. So I put aside that which is false, that I may be open to receive only that which is true. When that which is false is put aside and that which is true is received and accepted, the mind then listens to truth. In its own memory, it recognizes itself, as in the big S, and bids itself welcome. So I just love this, and I remember reading it in Gentle Contemplation with Regina. I think it was at the beginning we looked at Corinthians this year. And I just love this idea of the empty shell, and to me it's exactly the same as becoming an empty vessel. Sort of just letting go of those thoughts and labels and everything we know, and then coming back to this place of I don't know anything, which is difficult to do. It's difficult to do in every moment. Excuse me. So how do we do it? So I was thinking about this and how we do it, and I kind of just wanted to share some of which I'm contemplating at the moment and thinking about. So for me, the idea of becoming an empty vessel is about surrender. It's about surrendering. And I've been thinking a lot about the path and the search and the surrender and how one surrenders and what that means. And I personally feel I'm getting a bit closer to the point of surrender. So I thought I would just share with you where my mind's been and what's happening there. One is, and I don't know if any of you were able to listen on the weekend yesterday to the gathering, and Dove was talking about keeping things simple. So that was really the first thing, and I mentioned this yesterday in sort of the time after the gathering, that last year I was really guided to simplify whatever I was doing. And, you know, I always have hundreds of books on the go, and can feel almost a bit desperate in my attempts of this search, that something will give me a bit more information that will help me do more and help me do more. But I was really getting the signal that I should simplify. And just pick a text, just pick one, or you know, two or three, and just kind of read them slowly, which is also something I don't do. And chiefly go within, that was it. And the ego finds this very hard to do. This is what Dove was talking about yesterday, that it seems to think I should be doing more, I won't be doing enough. That's not enough if I, you know, want to reach God. And we're often told, you know, you have to apply yourself, you have to commit, you have to do the practice, which is almost like a bit of a forcing, but also necessary. So how do you sort of balance that feeling? And then at the same time, I was guided to work with the Tao as sort of a different train of thought. I was kind of told that was what was going to happen rather than anything. And I shared this yesterday, it's 81 verses, and they're very short, like today's, some of them are very short. And I thought, well, I'll do, you know, two or three a week. And then I heard, no, you're just going to do one a week. And I thought, oh my God, how do you fill an hour? And then I heard, well, you don't have to fill an hour, you can just do half an hour, or just play some music, it doesn't matter. But you're going to just take one a week, that's it. They're very short, you're going to think about them during the week. And so I naturally went out and bought tons of books, thinking that I would read everything I could possibly read. So basically not make myself empty, fill myself up with words so I could share and fill an hour instead of leaving an hour empty. And I wonder what it'd be like just to sit here and say, oh, we're gonna say nothing for an hour. The people would enjoy that more, I don't know. But so this happened and I was just told, that's all you're gonna do. And what happened was that I found that just reading the Tao once in the morning, and sometimes not every morning, it kind of just stays with me through the week. Certain words will crop up, or I'll wake in the night and I'll remember something, or I'll read something else, and then I'll think, oh, that's just like this verse in the Tao that we're looking at this week. So actually, by simplifying, I felt like I started to get to a place where I was beginning to surrender, because I'm realizing that I don't need to fill my mind, or it doesn't have to be this exhaustive search. It can be very gentle, that whatever it is that wants to talk to me is there. It just needs some space to come through. So I was beginning to get, as I say, in this mindset, and I've been studying with Regina's group, A Course in Miracles this year, which of course is very helpful because, as I mentioned, it talks about, you begin to understand with the workbook to let go of the meaning. Hi, Jay. So that's sort of where I was getting to, this idea of, or this sense of great, of simplifying my life and my thoughts and coming into this place of surrender. And one of the other things I've been looking at recently is I'm very much into mythology, and I'm very lucky this year I'm getting to study for free at Yale a course in mythology and religion and nature, and it's really very amazing. I'm very lucky. But one of the things that we keep talking about is the white stag. So I don't know if you know about the symbolism of the white stag, but it's very beautiful, so I thought I would share it. And it's this, you'll find it a symbol, and it comes up within Native American stories, medieval Europe, the Nordic regions and Scandinavia, North Asia and China. You'll find the white stag mentioned in Buddhism, in Zen Buddhism. In Christianity, the white stag appears with a crucifix between its antlers, and then it appears sometimes as a deer, more actually in Native American traditions. The symbol of the white stag is that we are, as humans, looking for something. And the hunt is actually a very sort of sacred journey, or used to be considered a sacred journey. I know these days it just go out and shoot stuff, but back in the day, it was this sense of going out into nature, and nature was seen as a place of purity, and wilderness as well. So it was this sort of magical, mystical place, and you went out onto your hunt, looking for something. And typically on this hunt, you were looking for something in the material world to kill a deer, or have some food or something like that, or like a trophy. But there's still this part of you that is obviously a little questioning, as you're going out, you're putting yourself out there. And then every single one of these stories has really the same outcome. So the person goes out on the hunt, they go into a forest or out on the prairies or in some sort of natural environment that's, able for your thoughts to clear. And while on this hunt, you see something, you catch a glimpse of something somewhere in the forest. It's like a flash of light, a flash of white. And it grabs your attention, and all of a sudden you begin to follow that. And you think, okay, I'm now hunting this. And so this sort of shift begins. You're now hunting something that seems elusive, that you're not sure what it is. And you're being drawn more and more into the forest. And then you catch sight of it, and it's a stag. And it's got enormous antlers, and it seems sort of mythical and magical. And you continue to chase it and chase it, and it leads you deeper and deeper and deeper into the forest until eventually the stag stops and turns around and looks at you. And in that moment, all of these myths say that you then become the quarry, that you understand in this moment that that which you were chasing is you, and it's really been chasing you. And then if you look at the various myths, or there's paintings, a lot of paintings, certainly around the time of Christianity was trying to get a hold of paganism in medieval Europe, you'll see there's a lot of depictions of religious people with this white stag and the crucifix between the antlers. But it was, or it is seen in nearly all sort of philosophies and religions as this point in your spiritual journey where you suddenly realize that you are what you are looking for. And in that moment, there is a shift, and it's a complete surrender to that path. And then usually the people that they talk about have had experiences will then go off and, do something for the world, or go and live in a cave, or become a monk, or, throw themselves on a pyre as a martyr, that kind of thing. Yeah, it's a really beautiful, a beautiful way of thinking about it. And if ever you have a white stag in a dream, then just sort of remember the symbolism. And as an aside, my professor was telling me, let me see if I can find the notes, that, and I didn't check this, so I don't know if this is true, but he was saying that the meaning of the meaning of the word symbol, is half the world. That's what it means, he said. It means you are only seeing half of the world. And so when you see a symbol such as a stag or whatever it is to you, it can be anything, a feather or something, what it's doing is completing the world. So at the moment we're just seeing the world, and it's trying to make whole for you what is there, which I just thought was really fascinating when we think about symbolism. And I'm a big fan of like looking at the birds I see on a daily basis and understanding what they mean, because I feel it helps me just sort of complete my world, give me a different perspective. But anyway, back to my point about the white stag. So I was reading Tess Hughes's book. Jacqueline Eckert did a satsang with her, and again, this was suggested in the gentle contemplation. I'm always getting the words gentle healing contemplation, that one, to look at that. And I was so blown away by that satsang that I bought her book. And what I noticed about her book, and so this gets to the point of the stag, that what she shares with it, thank you, Consistent Gentle Healing Group, it's called. What she shares in it is that every chapter she takes, it's a Zen teaching. And if you remember from the beginning, Zen really, I believe, comes a lot from the Tao Te Ching. It's hard to find parallels between Zen Buddhism and Taoism, but then it's also hard to find parallels between Taoism and the Tao Te Ching. Like it's often said, the Tao Te Ching was just a teaching put there by people who had no name for anything. It was like a shamanistic way of living, and the Tao Te Ching was written, and then it sort of got adopted into something more formal with ritual and became a religion in itself, Taoism. But it's said that Zen Buddhism sort of came originally from this very pure Tao Te Ching teaching of emptiness and simplicity. So Tess Hughes in her book has this lovely, she sort of approaches her story, it's a story of her spiritual path to awakening. She includes in the first part of each chapter, it's Zen teachings about the ox herdsman. It's about the story of an ox herdsman looking for an ox, and eventually finds the ox, brings the ox back, and then realizes he and the ox are the same. And it's these 10 stages that Zen Buddhists use to teach about the stages on the spiritual path. So it's very beautiful about this search for the ox. It's not dissimilar to the search for the stag. However, at the end of each chapter, she then includes like a Christian teaching that applies to the ox herdsman story. And it flips it completely on its head, where the ox is us and the ox herdsman is God. God is looking for us, looking for the ox herdsman. So I just thought I would read this just to give you a sense of what I'm talking about in case this seems strange. So in chapter two, and each of the Zen poems and comments goes along with a picture. That's how they were taught. So there's a picture of footprints, and it's called Noticing the Footprints. Along the riverbank, under the trees, I discover footprints. Even under the fragrant grass, I see his prints. And this is the ox herdsman talking. Deep in remote mountains, they are hidden. These traces can no more, I'm sorry, deep in remote mountains, they are found. These traces can no more be hidden than one's nose looking heavenward. And the commentator says, the second picture shows the ox herd has now caught sight of the tracks of the ox, bringing hope that his ox is not less lost forever. And this can be interpreted to mean that he has recognized his distress and has begun to seek for a solution in the teachings of Buddhism or other teachings. So this is how you would interpret this, looking for the ox or looking for the stag. That once you start to chase, you're beginning to think, hang on a minute, there is something here and I'm looking for a solution. I'm looking for something, I'm beginning to chase something. And then the commentator says, but he's still at the stage of thinking and talking about his problems. He's not yet found the path. However, the end of that chapter, this is the interpretation from Bernadette Roberts. And remember, this is God's point of view. Seeing our footprints going in the wrong direction, God can no longer abide his time. Like the hound of heaven, he begins to chase us down. So what are our options now? Should we run faster, try to hide, or as a true bull, daringly turn around, face him, and boldly ask him what he wants of us? And I just love this idea that flips it all on its head, the idea of searching. And the sort of will tie back in time, thinking about the search and the path and the practice and the search for God, that what this gave me was incredible comfort in that God is the one searching for us, which is such a relief that we are essentially the stag. And it sort of comes down when, you know, when the stag turns to look at you and you realize, oh, the stag was God, he brought me here, and now he's and it's me who's the quarry. So we are hunted by God. Yeah, exactly. So when you think of it like that, you think, well, okay, well, if God's hunting me down, or if God is in search of me, like really, if you someone said to you, oh, by the way, God's looking for you, what would you do? You would say, oh, I'll just make myself available. It's that simple. Okay, I'll just stand where I am. And did you get the memo? Are you talking to me or talking to Doreen? I don't know. Do you mean like, did you get the memo that God's looking for you? Yeah, you would just think, okay, what will I do? Yes, that meant my to say. And then it becomes very simple because what would you do? You would make yourself empty. You just empty yourself out so that God can just step right into your shoes you up. And when you look at it that way, or this is how I'm beginning to look at it on my own, is that then it becomes a much more it feels like an easier task. I know we talked at the beginning how it is a difficult task to empty yourself of thoughts, but when you are thinking about, well, God's coming looking for me, and all I have to do is empty myself and be available to him. Because obviously, if someone said, God's coming looking for you, did you get the memo? You're not going to say, oh, I did actually, and I'm going to start running. Well, maybe you would initially, but once you've been traveling the road a while, oh no, I'm totally available. Here's my address. So yeah, that was really kind of how I felt about this whole verse and what emptiness is. Becoming the empty vessel is really just allowing God to step in, and knowing that God, and I use the word God, but you know, spirit or Tao, or whatever you want to use, is coming looking for you. that it almost makes it easier. So yeah, I'm really enjoyed this verse. And this idea of, I think, like initially on your path, there is this play between the hunt and the surrender. Like, I'm hunting, I'm searching, and now I'm surrendering. I'm hunting, I'm searching, and now I'm surrendering. And I think as you get nearer and nearer to whatever, or as you move further along, I don't know, that's a wrong way of saying it, but at some point, the surrendering becomes more than the hunt. So I guess that's what I'm trying to say. So I just thought I'd read a couple more things on this, and then we'll finish on this verse. Where is it? So yeah, I've got, talk about being empty. I've got seven books out here. So I wanted to share Byron Katie's talk on this, or she's got like a couple of paragraphs she talks about with regards to this verse, and particularly the line, "It is like the eternal void filled with infinite possibilities." And she says, "We can call the Tao reality, we can also call it mind. Mind is a natural resource that never comes to an end. When it no longer believes its thoughts, it has entered the dimension of the unlimited." So when there is complete surrender and emptiness, it then enters the dimension of the unlimited. How beautiful. Enters the dimension of God, or allows spirit to step in. And that is like a bottomless well and can always be drawn from. It will always give you the water of life. Because it is completely open and sees that nothing is true, it is filled with more possibilities than we can ever imagine. And then at the end of this verse, and this is such an interesting verse because we don't hear Lao Tzu really talk about himself at all within the Tao Te Ching, but he actually says, "It is hidden but always present. I do not know who gave birth to it. It seems to be the common ancestor of all." Or as Stephen Mitchell says, "I don't know who gave birth to it. It's older than God." Older than God. It's such a sort of a mind-blowing thing to think about. And Byron Katie says here, Lao Tzu says, "I don't know who gave birth to it, but I do. You give birth to it every time your own mind opens to what is beyond what you think you know. And when your mind opens, what is beyond knowing, what is older than God, streams in as a gift, and there is no end to that gift." So again, there's that sense of once you let go of everything you think you know, that whole surrender, and the mind opens to what is beyond, what is older than God, that's just, I still can't get over that, then that streams in into you, and that's where this boundless energy comes. So you can be both the empty vessel and full at the same time. Okay, and then you see there are a couple of other little things I wanted to just draw on. Okay, one was this idea, and this is there's a book called The Instruction Manual for Receiving God, and I've quoted this before, I believe, but it says, "The ultimate container is God. That is a container that holds but does not contain. It contains but allows, and it's so big it allows everything." It says, "The God you hold in your head is too small. So let it fill your entire body." So I love this, and this idea of there you are in the forest and someone's following your footsteps, and you imagine what it is, and you think, "Oh my goodness, what is it going to do?" And then if you that idea is just too small in the end. You just have to open up your whole body and let God fill your whole self. And to hold God, you need an entire universe. And when you allow God to enter your body as well as your mind, you become that universe. And at the same time, the author says there's a sort of paradox in that you can be held by God. So you can have God within you, but you can be held by God at the same time. And only God is really big enough to hold all of you, which is such a comfort. To think of this huge thing coming for you that can completely swallow you up and handle all of your dramas, handle everything that you've got, can just be morphed into it and allow yourself to empty and then be filled up with something new, that empty shell. So I think that Ooh, yeah. So I thought I'd just end with this poem, and then there's a song I wanted to play, which is written it's written by God. In other words, like the words are from God to us. But I just wanted to read this poem first, and this is by Chang Su. In the beginning of beginnings was void of void, the nameless. And in the nameless was the one, without body, without form. This one, this being in whom all find power to exist, is the living. From the living comes the formless, the undivided. From the formless come the existence, each according to its inner principle, and that's form. Here, body embraces and cherishes spirit. The two work together as one, blending and manifesting their characters, and this is nature. But he who obeys nature returns through form and formless to the living, and in the living joins the unbegun beginning. The joining is sameness, the sameness is void, the void is infinite. The bird opens its beak and sings its note, and then the beak comes together again in silence. So nature and living meet together in the void, like the closing of the bird's beak after its song. Heaven and earth come together in the unbegun, and all is foolishness, all is unknown, all is like the lights of an idiot, all is without mind. To obey is to close the beak and to fall into unbeginning. There's a lot there, but I just thought I would read that. And now for this lovely song. Okay. And I have listened to this song on repeat for about 5 days because I just think it's so lovely to think of God coming to get us. And there is a line within it which I think I may have misinterpreted, but I prefer my interpretation. And it's something like, from the moment you know that you're very safe in the womb and that you're with God. And then the minute you leave it, you start running. And I just really love this idea that there we are, completely one with God. And then the minute we're born, we're moving away from God. And then hopefully we somehow one day go out for a hunt and come across a stag in a forest and follow the stag. And one day it turns towards us. Okay, here we go.
There's a train leaving your heart tonight. There's a silence inside your head. You're running from me. Down the tracks on a midnight line. There's a red moon in the sky. You're running from me. But I'm coming for you, coming for you wherever you go. I'm coming for you, I'm coming for you wherever you go. Oh. Restless angels till dawn breaks through. There's everlasting in the womb. In your between everything you think you know, eyes don't always hold you, but I'm never gonna stop falling for you. So when your eyes are gone and you will run strong, open your hands and look into my eyes. All that you see here you'll soon leave behind. So open your hands and look into my eyes. Cause I'm coming for you, coming for you, where you go. I'm coming for you, I'm coming for you, wherever you go. I'm coming for you, I'm coming for you, wherever you go. I'm coming for you, I'm coming for you, wherever you go. I'm coming for you, I'm coming for you, wherever you go.
I just love that. I also find it a real relief to just think about, you know, people might not come through for you who you have high expectations of, and that doesn't matter because there's someone else coming for you who is big enough to contain it all. So Jay has a story about a white stag and we have plenty of time to hear it. So Jay, I'm going to let go of the mic. If you want to share it.
Oh, hey, Helen. Can everybody hear me? And hey, Doreen. Hey, sure. Years ago, I participated in a series of Native American sweat lodge ceremonies with a real-to-life Lakota Sioux elder woman. This was in Nebraska. And we had a number of sort of, and they were sort of out in a forest. And we had a number of miraculous sort of earth spirit encounter happenings that I have no rational explanation for. One of them was once we exited the sweat lodge after our ceremony, there were in fact three stags that were lined up 10 feet from the sweat lodge, staring at us in a perfect line, staggered back like 10 foot, 10 foot, 10 foot. I mean, they were exactly standing in like formation, like perfectly staring at us with this energy. First of all, deer and stags and all that don't get that close to humans and just stand there. They keep their distance. And it was just a really powerful experience of communing with nature and the spirits of nature. And so indeed, we did encounter not one but three stags in the forest. They weren't white, though. They were brown. But that is the story. Giving up the mic.
I love that. I love that. And it's interesting, like, I mean, just, you know, by way of coincidence, three is the number for the Tao. So when you see things in three, it's like the Tao calling to you. And I saw a couple of white stags. It's a funny, silly story, really. It wasn't particularly spiritual, though I felt it. Well, maybe, who knows? Anyway, I'll shut up and carry on. So my boyfriend Bill and I, we went to the Isle of Skye, and as we were going over the bridge to the Isle of Skye, this huge rainbow appeared, and I was like, oh my God, this is a sign, you know, the Isle of Skye, we should be here. And I said to him, we should be here. Look, there's the sign, there's a rainbow here. And it was, I don't know if you've ever had the chance to go to the Isle of Skye, but it is magical. I mean, I've just never seen anything like it. And in fact, I sort of came away going, I cannot believe I lived in England all these years and I feel like this was kept a secret from me because I would have lived here. It's just incredibly beautiful. I mean, and there are fairy glens everywhere, and these very big burly Scots talking about fairies in this very real way. I mean, you can go and see the fairy flag, you can go to the fairy bridge where the fairy queen helped one of the clansmen. It's just very, very magical. You saw Jay saw fairies too. But anyway, so when we happened to be leaving, and he wasn't on drugs, when we happened to be leaving, another rainbow appeared as we were leaving. I think we were getting the very back. And I said to Bill, you know, really, this is pretty much a sign. And we were driving home through the Highlands. We just started coming off the ferry from the Isle of Skye, and we're just starting that drive back through the Highlands. And I said, you know, if we see white stag, we have to move here. And then 2 minutes later, two white stag crossed the road and scuttered away. And I was like, oh my God, that must be a sign. Bill said, no, I'm not sure. And I said, okay, well, if we see an otter dancing on a dolphin, then we're moving to Skye. But yeah, Jay's saying he saw little green-winged people. Do you want to share about that? I'm pretty sure I saw one once. No one believed me, but I'm certain. I just can't find an insect that looked like it. Okay, all right then. I'm glad we've got all this time tonight. This is nice. Okay, Jay, mic's yours.
Yeah, this is actually another experience with the very same Lakota Sioux Native American elder woman on a different night that we did. We did about, I don't know, six or seven of them throughout this one summer. And we were singing these songs and being very devotional to Mother Earth and all this. And they opened the doors. They're called doors, east, west, north, and south, and in a certain order. It's part of the ceremony. And I thought I saw a bunch of very large fireflies outside. And I thought, oh, that's cool that the fireflies, you know, have come around our sweat lodge. That's really cool. And then I looked away, and then something tweaked in my brain, like, wait a minute, those were bigger than fireflies. And then I looked again, and son of a gun, they were exactly like the books. I sort of freaked out a little bit, but not too much. Because I actually was seeing something I saw in a children's book that I didn't think was real, was fake. And there was dozens and dozens of these things, and they were little green people with wings like you'd think of from the books. Iridescent. They were not of this dimension, so to speak, but they made themselves visible in this dimension. And later, when we closed down the sweat lodge at the end of the night, it was getting dark. And as I was leaving, we had to use a flashlight to get back on this trail to go back to where our cars were. And I caught one of them in the flashlight beam for just a split second, and he instantly disappeared. Just like they didn't like the light shone on him like that or something. It was just very, I guess there would be like a cat, you know, they're only going to come around if they feel like it. You can't make them do anything. You know, it's like you invite them in and they're there, and it's more like they make themselves visible to you. You know, I don't know if we would have had a camera rolling, if they would have caught on the film, if this was something that was just occurring in the mind as a perception. I don't know. I don't have any scientific data on that, but I no longer believe that all that stuff was just fake. I really actually realized it was real. There really is beings like that, and they don't live in our dimension, but they can make themselves visible to you if you so choose to. Different classes of beings that exist in mind and the dream and the illusion that are part of our experience. So I believe those Scottish people that talk about fairies as being real because I guess I saw them. So giving up the mic.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you. And I feel like the more open we are, why wouldn't we welcome those things? Why, I mean, how beautiful that experience was for you. So when we make ourselves empty, I guess, trying to wrap it up, then all these beautiful things happen to us, and God shows us like some amazing things that we never would have seen had we were we so locked in our own ways of thinking. So thanks. I'm really happy we had this sharing at the end. Thanks, Jay. That's great. And I hope you will have a really lovely week. Again, if you want to, just take a look at the fifth verse, maybe read it one morning and see what comes to you over the day. And I'll give up the mic. It's time for Doreen via Cheryl. So thank you. And yeah, see you later.